You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 235. Oh, Ed Sheeran is leaving social media. Maybe we should all take a break. Hang on, I'll see if anyone agrees with me on Twitter. Okay, see you, Ed. Ah, more bad news. Chelsea have sacked Jose Mourinho. It was never his fault. Or so he told us. We look at the best sporting excuses and we look back at our worst gig experiences. That's all coming up after the small hours and midnight to six.
Great track, chosen by Juliet, from the rather underground mod revival in the late 70s, Small Hours and Midnight to Six. Welcome to podcast episode 235.
Wow, this just keeps happening, doesn't it? We just won't go away, will we?
It just keeps increasing every week, Jules. I'm Terence Stackham, and she may be the song that summer sings, may be the chill that autumn brings, may be 100 different things. She's Juliet Harris.
Snort. Hello. Thank you. Coming with a onesie this week. I am recording this podcast in a onesie. What can I say? I really do have no shame nowadays.
My giddy aunt. Jules, earlier this week, Ed Sheeran used his Instagram account in a sort of bizarre juxtaposition to alert his followers, and he's got 5.5 million
wow.
of them.
Wow.
I know that he's taking a break from social media, emails and his phone, as he put it. And he said, I find myself seeing the world through a screen and not my eyes. So I'm taking this opportunity of me not having to be anywhere or do anything to travel the world and see everything I've missed. Now, Ed Sheeran is in the lucky position, of course, to have the money and time to effectively turn the world to the off position. But, you know, Jules, don't you sometimes wish you could do the same?
I have to say, I sneakingly admire Ed Sheeran for doing this. I must admit, admittedly, he's in an enormously privileged position of you know, having a great deal of money and being able to do this. In terms of taking a break from your phone, Well, I mean, a prime example. I would worry that I wouldn't be able to get in touch with people in an emergency. That'd be the only thing that would stop me from completely ditching my phone. And indeed, my dad telephoned my landline just as we were about to start doing our podcast.
It just goes to. I heard it.
Indeed,
live.
Yes, you were involved in that. So it just goes to show you now that perhaps it's always parents that call landlines, isn't it? Because it's that generation. But it just goes to show that, you know, there are ways of getting in touch with people that aren't a sort of a screeny mobile phone. I agree with him. It's so easy to fall into that habit of, you know, being on the phone or on the iPad all the time and you know, seeing things. It's when you find yourself, and this doesn't happen very often to me, but there have been moments where I've found myself viewing things happening around me in terms of photo opportunities / writing opportunities rather than, you know, an opportunity to live life. And I can't help but feel that's a dangerous road. So I admire it. Although Ed Sheeran is in a very privileged position, I admire him for identifying that and doing that, because I think all things in moderation are good fun. But there is a danger that social media life replaces your actual life, and I don't think that's a road to happiness.
I think I absolutely genuinely do have a problem in that I have some sort of addictive personality. I've self-analysed in the last couple of years, because I almost get a fixation about some things, excuse me, which includes Twitter. I only follow 100 people. But I have this feeling that, having made that commitment, I have to see all of their tweets. And so I backtrack, Jules, to the last time I checked Twitter. And then I read all the tweets of those 100 people until I catch up to the present time. And I do that constantly. So I think I may need to pay heed to Ed Sheeran and, you know, give far less importance to social media, especially Twitter. But I really do think I have a bit of a problem with it, because I have a tendency for what I call binginess.
I'm enjoying this as a concept. So binginess is a state of mind, etc. Yeah, that's so good.
I'll give you an example. Recently, and I do this a lot, I'll obsess about a particular TV show and then I'll watch it all in one go. I watched all episodes of the two seasons of The Detectorists in two sittings.
I love that. I think that is a highly applaudable activity to do. That is, me and my dad are both big fans of Detectorists. It's the best thing on television, I think. So who could blame you for wanting to watch it?
I suppose, but you know, here's a weird one. I've recently been obsessed with watching reruns of the American Home Renovation show, This Old House.
You see, I'm not familiar with this. This sounds like
it's a bit like Grand Designs.
Oh, right,
but,
okay.
It's they renovate houses in, usually in the sort of Boston area, old sort of Georgian or you know, from the colonial days. But the thing is that, and I find it absolutely fascinating, but they spread their renovations, not like Grand Designs, into 1 hour. They do it at maybe 15 episodes of 30 minutes each, or 20.
Oh, right, okay. And is that all the same house?
All in the same house. Ooh. But you see, the thing is, Jules, I can easily watch all 15, 25-minute episodes in two, maybe even just one sitting.
Wow.
So, you know, maybe 6 hours sitting. A really good way to get a numb bum from sitting on the sofa.
And then I'm the same with The Simpsons. I could happily, you know, I tape, there we go, that's how old school I am. I set the I haven't got Sky, but I've got BT Vision, which allows you to set things on Series Link, and so I have a automatic setting. Anytime The Simpsons is on at any point, my box will record it, as a result of which I have something like 110 episodes of The Simpsons in my thing. And there are days where if I sat down at 10 o'clock in the morning and started watching The Simpsons, I would easily watch, yeah, I don't know, they're about 25 minutes if you scroll through the episode.
Yeah.
And I could easily watch, you know, half a dozen at one go. And I was thinking about this. Maybe we live in a multi-channel world, not just in a television way, but in a kind of an everything way. And we've talked about this in terms of music before, haven't we, and how hard it is to swim through things. And maybe the reason that we do this is that because there are so many channels now, even without Sky, I find there are lots and lots of channels and lots of things that are constantly on. It's so hard to find something you like that when I find something that I genuinely really enjoy, you always get a bit overexcited, really, and just want to sort of shovel it all in, like food. You just want to shovel it all in, really. I mean,
yeah.
I, the only way in which I am old school rather than binging is that Only Connect is my other favourite programme on TV, apart from Detectorists. And I will literally schedule my entire day around where I will be at 7:30 to watch Only Connect. I've to the point where I've sat in semi-strangers' houses before and watched Only Connect. So maybe it's not so much a sort of maybe not so much problem behaviour as us trying to make sense of an increasingly kind of fragmented world. Who knows? Maybe that's too profound. Maybe we should just do things that aren't watching television for hours on end.
So lion or water for the wall? Oh, was it? No, sorry.
Lion.
That's a revelation what you've just said. I think you're right. I think that actually is it with me as well, is that finding something that I can actually engage with, which is a rarity for me in terms of television, I then binge on it for that reason.
And to take it back to our original topic, I don't know if I'm reaching here. I might be slightly. I might sound a little bit like those Open University academics that get on the news to talk about things and overanalyze stuff. But maybe in terms of social media and whether we use social media too much, and Ed Sheeran's point that I think he's trying to make, that you know, rather than experience what's going on around him, he's trying to document it through social media. Maybe, you know, I say we live in an ever fragmented world. There is so much going on around us all the time, so much that there's, well, they call it FOMO, don't they? Fear of missing out. Mm. And it's so easy to think, you know, I'm missing this. I'm not experiencing this properly. I'm missing this. But once you, it's like latching onto something, like, you know, with our TV thing and, oh, well, I found something I like, so I'll do it all the time. Once you latch onto something, you think, oh, well, I have experienced this properly because here I am taking pictures or a video or things like that. Mm. Maybe that's why we do it, because we're aware that we can't possibly experience everything that goes on around us. So maybe we're trying to document what we can. I don't know.
Yeah, that's. I think that's almost certainly it. I mean, I must say, it's not just this old house. In the last year or so, you know, I've done the same with 30 Rock. Mm-hmm. I've rewatched all of Seinfeld.
Oh, wow.
From
at least you have good taste. You see, I have an increasing addiction problem with Don't Tell the Bride, which is not high quality television.
Oh, yeah.
If you're talking about tacky TV to get addicted to, because I think the reason why these programs, you know, this house thing you're talking about and Grand Designs, I used to watch that a lot with an Xbox. Well, he was very keen. We used to watch several episodes at a time. And again, this Don't Tell the Bride, that they all follow, although they're reality in inverted commas TV, they all follow the same narrative and the same storyline.
Yes.
I can highly recommend.
It's kind of comforting,
isn't
it? It is.
And I can highly recommend, there might be a This Old House equivalent. There is something called Grand Designs Bingo, which you can download online, which is like a drinking game, which gives you points for various things that happen. And it does point out just how repetitive these things are. So it says, you know, she gets pregnant during the build and they go over budget and Kevin MacLeod has a swim in the swimming pool at the end, things like that. So
the windows are always delayed coming from Germany.
Yes, absolutely. Or Taiwan or something.
Yeah,
and they're always, you know, they always find some kind of terrible rot under the stairs, don't they? So so maybe we're just trying to, you know, we're just desperately trying to make sense of an increasingly confusing world. And good for Ed Sheeran for recognising that and trying to live a life, I suppose.
I think I need to try and join in, break this Twitter, YouTube, Periscope.
Absolutely. Or that, either that or he's very welcome to come round and watch The Simpsons with me if he wants to clear his life in that way.
Jose Mourinho, he's the master at blaming others. We'll be looking at the greatest sporting excuses right after this from Lord Echo.
Tell you that I love you by your name to come.
It's a delicious version of the Nile Rodgers Bernard Edwards hit for Sister Sledge, Lord Echo and Thinking of You, with Lisa Tomlins on vocals. Now, talking of social media, funnily enough, I heard the news about Jose Mourinho through Twitter.
I was
at my desk writing, and there was no TV or radio going, and I glanced up at TweetDeck, and my friend Matthew was telling me that Mourinho was gone. So, you know, it did have its uses as well.
Absolutely.
Now, there's one thing we can be sure of, and that is that nothing that went wrong at Chelsea, in his eyes, will be Jose Mourinho's fault.
No, poor old Jose, he was dealt such a bad hand. You see, there you are. I'm very sympathetic for him.
He's built a career on being the king of excuses.
He has.
Here's some examples. In 2011, when he was at Real Madrid, his side lost to Barcelona. He said, there were no ball boys in the second half, which is something typical of Barcelona. Now, if we fast forward 3 years to December 2014, Chelsea lost 2-1 at Newcastle. I did a bit of research, looked at the quotes. We wanted to play, but it wasn't possible. The ball goes out, it doesn't come back, and the ball boys run away. And finally, last Monday, Chelsea lost 2-1 at Leicester. Quote, the ball boys were a disgrace to the Premier League. So if it isn't the ball boys, the referees give too much stoppage time or not enough stoppage time. Referees don't give Chelsea penalties, but they readily give them to the opposition. And finally, of course, everything is the fault of the team doctor who treated an injured player.
Absolutely, yes. Who I suspect, I really hope, is A, living like a princess now, and B, absolutely yes, roaring with laughter for 24 hours a day, frankly.
I did say yesterday, I think, that if Chelsea really wanted to show they've got class, they would send a chauffeured limousine to drive Dr. Eva Carneiro back to work.
Absolutely.
On Monday morning and garland her with roses as she appears.
And say, thank you ever so much for being the mirror to show us what an absolute idiot Jose has been. And I've self-edited with idiot there, but you know what I mean.
Jules, we've got plenty of other world-class sporting
excuses. Oh, yes,
excuses.
Indeed. Top-level gold-plated sporting excuses. Viewers may recall the amazing adventures of Luis Suarez, chomper to the stars, who gave evidence to a FIFA panel his sort of biting, the peak of his biting career, which had many and various episodes, was when he had a nice little munch on poor old Giorgio Chiellini, the Italian defender at the 2014 World Cup. And this quote is gold. So when they asked him why he had bitten this chap, he said, I lost my balance, making my body unstable and falling on top of my opponent. At that moment, I hit my face against the player, leaving a small bruise on my cheek and a strong pain in my teeth and sorrow in his heart, presumably, as well. And he was banned for 4 months, so I don't think FIFA really bought that. I think that that is great. It almost brings parallels of this court case at the moment with this chap that's accused of raping this woman claims that he fell on top of her. That's almost as plausible, I think, if you see what I mean. It's poor old hungry Luis Suarez, the hungry hippo of world-class football.
Fulham Football Club have fallen on hard times. They've dropped out of the Premiership and seem now to be in a constant battle with being relegated further.
It's a pity because it wasn't very long ago since they were in the Europa League final, is it, really? So
absolutely,
crazy how
yes.
quickly things can change.
That was Roy Hodgson, I think, wasn't it, as manager.
Yeah.
What an extraordinary twist.
My colleague at the time was a big Fulham fan, and he went to all of those European games abroad. And I had the fond memories of Graham falling asleep at his desk at 1:15 in the afternoon and me having to cover for him. That was my biggest memory of Fulham's cup, trying to wake Graham up at various intervals.
At that time, Fulham were owned by the then Harrods owner,
Mohamed Fayed.
And extraordinarily, he decided to get this massive statue of Michael Jackson built just outside the ground, which I do know I've got many Fulham supporters as friends. And, you know, they sort of saw it as, you know, something to sort of hide your, avert your eyes. Yeah. It was so tasteless and you know, just so badly done. But so then Mohammed Fayed sold Fulham, and the new owner, Shahid Khan, removed the statue of Michael Jackson from outside the ground, much to the delight, as I said, many Fulham supporters. But of course, it was ever since that statue has been removed that their decline has happened.
And open and shut case, scientific evidence, I think.
Absolutely, and of course, Mohammed Fayed has not been shy in noting that. He said, "This statue was a charm, and we removed the luck from the club, and now we have to pay the price." And I think it's a rare example of someone still clutching to Michael Jackson as a lucky charm.
Well, that's good to say. Notable in its uniqueness in its own way. That is a noted restrained person that is Mohammed El Fayed. He was characteristically calm and rational in his response, I see.
Yes, and now you're moving on to the former governor of the Bank of England.
Yes, indeed. Mervyn King, who I thought was the former governor of the Bank of England. Turns out he also plays darts, presumably in his spare time, or they might be different people, but I suspect they probably are. Yes, it's not just football, which have ridiculous excuses. Mervyn King, he lost to Raymond van Barneveld, who I grew up watching darts, and Barneveld had sort of semi-legendary status in my household. We thought he was amazing. So he lost to Barneveld in the World Darts Championship semi-final. And Mervyn King said the problem with this was air conditioning. He said, "I asked for it to be turned off before I went up there, and it wasn't. I asked for it to be turned off at the break. It wasn't. The air conditioning doesn't affect Raymond because he throws a heavier dart and a very flat dart." And the best bit is the final line of this story, which was the organisers insisted the air conditioning had been switched off for the entire match. I quite like TV documentaries where you watch it and then at the end there's the sort of the "here's what happened next" writing on the screen. And I love the idea that Mervyn King spent an hour of a TV documentary moaning that there's been no air conditioning. And it just says at the end, in that kind of lovely non-judgmental white text on a back black screen, "the air conditioning was off for the whole match." I thought that was just so, so good. It's like someone claiming that the song they're singing is not in their key. I think it's just such a such a great kind of a excuse. And you feel like saying, "Look, Merv, you just lost."
Well, indeed. Football, though, is the gift that keeps on giving when it comes to excuses. And we go back to when former England goalkeeper David James was playing at Liverpool.
Oh, I know what this is going to be. I love this. It's my all-time favourite.
This is my favourite. They conceded three goals. He let in three rather soft goals against Newcastle in 1997. And David James admitted he wasn't quite with it because he'd been playing games for hours at a time on his PlayStation. And he said, "I was getting carried away playing Tekken 2 and Tomb Raider for hours on end."
You see, I loved that because that was in 97. And at that point in time, I was someone that was spending hours on end playing Tekken 2. So actually, who knows, maybe what they should have done was put David James on the PlayStation and put me in goal for Liverpool at that point as a 13-year-old girl. And I think that would have worked perfectly. I can't see how that could have possibly been worse. I remember him jumping out into the penalty when someone took corners. He would jump out into the area and completely miss punches, wouldn't he? It was awful.
Yeah, again, just like someone with a PlayStation controller.
Absolutely, yes. He looked very I admire David James. He used to write the columns in The Observer and they were always quite interesting and apparently largely written by him, although I was sad and rather disappointed to hear recently that he's basically sold all of his possessions because he had some bankruptcy hearing or something, which I would have thought he was a bit more sensible for that. But he did one of those kind of brief interviews in The Observer once, and it made me chuckle because he seemed to have a sense of humour that went beyond most sort of ordinary footballers. And they said, "What do you do to relax at weekends?" And he said, "I sit on the M4 relaxing with millions of my fellow commuters," which I thought was quite good. But yes, poor old J-Mo. You'd think that someone would have sat down and said to him, "Oh, you know, perhaps you don't do it." But then again, you might argue it was indicative of Liverpool's problems at that time. They had an enormously talented team that were very young, the sort of the Spice Boy kind of culture that didn't really go anywhere. And actually, I've started reading a publication called The Blizzard, which is a quarterly kind of posh fanzine. And the reason I got into it is because there was an extract from an article, which was still incredibly long, in The Guardian. I think it was by Rob Smith, who's a regular Guardian writer, about Liverpool and Manchester United in 95 to 97 and comparing the Spice Boys to the class of 92. And it's really, I would highly recommend to anyone that's interested in football and popular culture. It was really, really interesting. So I would recommend that if one also wants to read about the further adventures of Calamity James, as he unfortunately became known at that point.
Well, talking of the class of 92, our final example comes very much from that era.
Yeah, 92. And actually, again, this 1996 sort of thing, I think I got rid of it, which is such a pity. But I had this grey Manchester United shirt. I had this shirt. and ironically, I had this shirt because they didn't have the blue and white one in stock, which is the one that I really wanted. Oh, God, yeah. And this says the story, the Independent said, it reported at the time, Manchester United's grey football kit yesterday became a collector's item as the strip they couldn't see was consigned to the dustbin after less than a season. The outfit was blamed for a string of disappointing results and were replaced by an all-white version. The last straw came on Saturday at Southampton when, after going in 3 goals down at half-time, this was in the days when that was a surprise at Manchester United, the United manager, Alex Ferguson, ordered a switch to the team's blue and white third kit. The change worked, but only partially, as Manchester United lost 3-1. The players couldn't pick each other out, Ferguson said. They said it was difficult to see their teammates at a distance when they lifted their heads. It was nothing to do with superstition. And I had a book at the time that was released around the time that was sort of funny things that people have said in football. It was a bit like Coleman balls, but not, if you see what I mean. And the front cover had Ryan Giggs with his back to the camera with Giggs 11 on the back of his shirt, and Gary Pallister facing the camera talking to him. And Gary Pallister is saying, "Excuse me, have you seen Ryan Giggs anywhere?" So yes, it was very it was weird, wasn't it? That was in the days when Manchester United were unstoppable. Didn't they lost to someone 6-3 during that run as well, if I remember correctly, which was completely unheard of at that point. It was pretty. But yes, you'd think, well, do they not test these things out beforehand? Do they not think, well, maybe players won't see each other?
You would think. Well, there's a great line of excuses, but I think for consistency over a decade or more, the award for long-term service in the field of sporting excuses must be retained by Jose.
That is one sense in which he is a winner at the moment.
He is a big winner. We're back after this splendid single from 1984.
Meaning, I
amazingly only reached number 52 in the UK chart for Julian Cope, The Greatness and Perfection of Love.
I feel he was robbed, wasn't he? Cope's been robbed of a lot of hits, I feel, over the years.
He has. He certainly his solo career. That always there. You see all top position in the charts. You know, 52, 47, 63. They're always, you know, just outside the main frame.
I feel that. Dear old Jim. Indeed. One day maybe he will accept his reward.
Bless your cotton socks.
I'll stop now.
Frank Sinatra was born on December the 12th, 1915. So this week, if he was still with us, it would have been his 100th birthday.
Wow.
And of course, newspapers and magazines and broadcast media have been full of memories of Sinatra in his glory days. It's arguable that Songs for Swinging Lovers from 1956 is one of the great albums of all time. And certainly, maybe it could be argued the best from the pre-Beatles era. But the talk about Sinatra this week led me back to a sad memory, really, because never go to see your heroes in their declining years.
Yes.
Is the moral. It was 1992, and my then girlfriend and I, it's always my then girlfriend.
Oh, Terrence.
I know. We managed to get tickets to see Frank Sinatra at the Royal Albert Hall.
Wow, yeah.
And I can remember really looking forward to it. You know, you say, oh, I'm going to go, you know, we're going to see an icon, really. And I remember we listened to Songs for Swinging Lovers on cassette, of course. In the car on the way to Kensington. I can remember everything being really good. You know, we managed to park really near the Royal Albert Hall, plenty of time for a drink and so on. But then it all went downhill because from the moment he was guided, and I do mean guided onto the stage, it was obvious he wasn't fully quite aware of what was going on. And I suppose they were less politically correct times. And I can remember we kind of said to each other, you know, it's like he wasn't all there.
Mm.
But he only did about an hour. His voice was shot to pieces.
Oh, gosh.
He was trying really hard, but just the magic had gone. And the audience were great, you know, standing ovations and so on. But it was as if we were applauding him for times gone by.
What he'd done previously, rather than that evening.
Yeah, what he was presenting, on that night in May 1992. Have you ever looked forward to a gig and then been disappointed?
Yes, I have. A few years ago, and again, none of my stories are in the Frank Sinatra legend bracket, I'm afraid. They're much more in the kind of trained indie kid bracket. I, and also, this makes you feel any better, I and my then-girlfriend went to see, we went to see a band called Editors. Excuse me, sorry. We went to see a band called Editors at the Brighton Dome, and this would have been, I think, sometime in 2009, possibly. Yeah, it would have been summer 2009. And Editors, much derided. Actually, although I genuinely really like Editors as a band, I can never stop thinking about it. I think it was a Guardian guide that once described them as an ITV2 version of Joy Division, which I thought was such a lovely insult. But I really, you know, I had their first album, The Back Room. I really, really liked it. Their second album came out, and I really liked that as well. And Laura really liked Editors as well, so I said, well, she lived in Brighton. So we said, oh, we'll get tickets. And, you know, and again, we went out for a meal beforehand. It was really nice. And you know, we got there. And the support, there were two support bands who were both quite interesting. And Editors came on stage and we were really looking forward to them. Although we didn't stand with them, a girl that I got on the train with at the time to go to work called Anne and her partner, they'd seen them previously at a festival and they really liked them too. And they said, oh, they'll be brilliant. We saw them and they were really tight and they were really good. And they came on stage and they played, I can't remember what it was played, played one of my favourites to open, and there was something wrong. And I don't know what it was, but there was something wrong. And halfway through the song, the drummer got out of time, which we didn't expect from a band that I think they were Mercury nominated. You wouldn't expect it. The drummer got out of time and then got back in. And then got out again to the point where the bass player walked over and started talking to the drummer. And although he didn't go out, sort of, it really cast a shadow over the gig because everyone was very tense as to what was going to happen next. And when the singer did the kind of introducing the band bit, he didn't introduce the drummer. He introduced everyone else and not the drummer, and everyone kind of didn't really know where to look. And weirdly, a few months after that gig, the guitarist was announced as having left. And we thought, God, well, if it was going to be anyone, surely it would have been the drummer. But clearly they were looking back on it. They were a band who were experiencing problems at that point. But yeah, that was quite disappointing. Because we'd expect, and afterwards when we saw this couple that we knew, the lady said, well, she said, they weren't very tight, weren't they? They were much tighter when we saw them. And you know, she said it was quite, because their sound was very much dependent upon being very, almost Joy Division-esque, very, very relentless and very driving. And we were very sad to see a band just not play very well, really. And that was a real disappointment. The other disappointing story that I've got is, and again, not being able to play, but bands and venues not knowing their audiences. I'm quite a big fan of the Papini sisters. If listeners don't know who they are, they're sort of three youngish women who basically take off the Andrews sisters, but they often do covers of modern songs. So, and they were doing this before it became sort of mainstream. They were one of the first people that did it. So I think this would have been about 10 years ago when we'd seen. They were doing things like Panic by the Smiths in a kind of a jazz way, and Walk Like an Egyptian, and Wuthering Heights. Their version of Wuthering Heights is really good, actually. It's worth investigating. And they are like the Andrews sisters, but with a kind of a sort of slightly alternative leanings. And they came up at the Dedewal Pavilion, and I lent my parents one of the albums, and they really liked it. And I suspect my dad really liked it because it was like the Andrews sisters. I mean, my dad calls Morrissey that whining bloke, so the fact that they were covering the Smiths would not mean a lot to my dad, but they really liked them. And so my cousin came down to visit, and so the four of us went to see the Papini sisters at Bexhill Dedewal Pavilion. And I think it's important to give the context of this. The Bexhill Dedewal Pavilion is now a fantastic venue that has loads of really big bands there. I saw Suede there in the summer. I saw Belle and Sebastian there last year. They've got Savages coming up. Richard Hawley plays it, and they've got some really good quality, slightly alternative leaning bands there. But Bexhill as a town is very elderly in its population. And I mean that kindly, but it is very elderly. And before they revamped the Delaware about 15 years ago, the kind of it used to reflect its local population. So it used to do World War II revival orchestras, and which I have been to see before. And I saw Cleo Lane there once, who was great. But Agatha Christie, Amdram Productions and things like that. It was an elderly audience. And when we turned up for the Papini sisters, I said to my dad beforehand, I wonder who go to this. And the majority of the audience were not postmodern, ironic young bods like me. They were very elderly people who'd gone to see people that sang like the Andrews sisters. And the support band were a band called the Brute Chorus. And I remember seeing the name and thinking, oh, I hope this is going to work. And they came on, and they were the loudest, noisiest punk band I have ever heard. And the idea was that the Papini sisters were selling themselves. And actually, after that, when I saw a description for a gig afterwards, basically the Papini sisters' sell was that they had a backing band, a drummer and a bass player that were very kind of sort of all slightly alternative, very kind of almost rockabilly-esque, and so they were quite loud and noisy, and they were in this support band. And I remember the look of horror on all the faces of everybody around me, and they were so loud to the point where afterwards it appeared that they had damaged some of the sound equipment. And the Papini sisters were very, very, very dependent upon the fact that they sing in very close harmony. And so after the support band, who were, you know, people were walking out, it was terrible. So after the support band had finished, I could hear ringing that wasn't in my ears. There was ringing in the sound speakers, and I saw various people round the sound desk, almost like an ER, trying to fix it. And then when the Papini sisters came on, the vocals didn't really work because they were having such problems with the sound by that point. And of course, afterwards, my dad said, when I could hear them, I thought they were amazing, but God, they've really got to ditch that support band, because it was, and it made me realize, and the backing band was similar as well. And it made me realize it was disappointing because whoever it was that put them on hadn't thought through the consequences of the audience. And I think they'd expected to get a postmodern audience. I mean, if they did it now, they'd probably get a lot of postmodern people over from Brighton and, you know, people from Hastings Old Town. But, you know, it was literally the Blue Rinse Brigade, who did not take very kindly to the Brute Chorus, I'm afraid. Gosh. It was a very tense evening. It was frustrating because it should have been something that we all really, really enjoyed. And actually, I didn't mind it, but I was tense because I knew everyone around me wasn't enjoying it. It was not the most enjoyable evening I've ever had, sadly. And again, they were on at the Festival Hall, and I said, well, shall we go? And my parents used to go point blank. So they've lost two fans, I'm afraid.
Oh dear, how peculiar. Well, probably equally as disappointing as my second and final example. Certainly weirder was going to see the Sex Pistols at Brunel University in Uxbridge.
Oh, right, okay. See, your stories are always cooler than mine.
Oh, I don't know. I looked it up earlier, and funnily enough, it was December the 16th.
Oh,
so,
was it? But, yeah.
1977, almost 38 years ago.
It was 38 years ago today, Sergeant Pepper, etc., etc.
I was terribly young.
Yes, I'm sure you were. Yes, just a child.
And in my usual introductory way, my then girlfriend and I,
yes,
we didn't have tickets for this Sex Pistols at Brunel University, and our very unreliable car broke down on the way.
Oh,
so
no.
by the time we got there, we did eventually get there, but the chaos was already well
yes.
underway. There was a small crowd of people outside trying to get in, but it was so badly organised that it didn't seem to matter if you had a ticket or not.
You could just walk in, yeah.
But, George, this was a really, really weird thing. There was a really horrible atmosphere. The Sex Pistols were hours late, and for some reason I've never understood, and I must sort of go Googling to see if anyone else has remembered this. I don't know whether it was the students, I don't know who did this, but some people had built a sort of barricade of tables and chairs at the actual entrance to the sports hall. I don't know whether it's trying to stop people getting in or other people getting out.
Oh,
I don't
God,
know. But, I mean,
yeah.
Thank God there wasn't a fire, can you imagine?
Well, yes.
But it really was a kind of tumble of tables and chairs built up like, you know, the Bastille.
Oh,
the storming of the Bastille.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really peculiar thing. Anyway. We eventually, from outside, we could hear the Pistols starting to play. And so everyone just shoved their way in through this barricade into the hall, you can imagine. And, of course, a couple of 18-year-old students on the door had no way of stopping 50 young punks bundling
in.
I'd like to tell you, you know, it was an exciting gig, but it was just awful. And, you know, people who weren't there at the time, like, oh, it must have been great, you know, punk. Rock and everything. It was awful. The sound was terrible. It was just like a fuzzy cacophony. Sid Vicious had no shirt on, and of course he couldn't play bass guitar, no matter what anybody tries to pretend. He was just hitting random strings on his bass guitar. I can remember John Lydon just spent most of the gig standing on Paul Cook's drum riser, and he was just shouting at people in the front couple of rows, just, you know, trying to wind them up. I don't think they played more than about 40 minutes. It was just awful. And it really did feel like, and it really felt like it at the time, you know, it felt like the end of punk. I thought, this is the end of it now, you know. And so almost certainly, it was worse than Frank at the Royal Albert Hall. For me, it was almost certainly the most disappointing gig ever.
Yeah, that sounds dispiriting, doesn't it, really? And it's funny that people think, oh, you know, people often think the peak of punk try saying that after a few drinks, is 1977 and God Save the Queen and all that. But for what you've just said, it sounded like punk was already dead by 1976. It's very...
I really do think it was, yeah. You know, just one other aside, which I was thinking of when I was remembering this, you know, and... people, you know, sort of when people think back to the glory days of punk rock, and they picture all these people at the gigs wearing, you know, the sort of leather trousers and jackets with, you know, Crass or something written on the back in white Tippex. Yeah. You know, the majority of people that I used to see at punk gigs, whether it was the Clash or the Pistols or Susie and the Banshees in 1977, the majority of people attending had long hair, flared trousers, and beards. You know, the actual sort of punk movement was, you know, limited to a couple of hundred people who lived in the suburbs.
Who were really into it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so I think not so much rose-tinted glasses, but, you know, plastic faux leather.
Yes, and interesting you say that. I don't know if you've read Tracy Thorne's book, the Bedsit Disco Queen book.
Yes, I have.
She talks in it, doesn't she, about where does she live? She lives in some very outer London suburb, doesn't she?
She lived in a North London suburb at the
time. And she talks about, you know, being obsessed with punk and trying to look punky in her trousers in her bedroom, and then sort of sneaking on trains to get in. So, yes, it seemed like the sort of almost a bit. I think there are parallels with Britpop, really. There were lots of people that were sort of like me, who were a bit young for Britpop, who were following it from their bedrooms rather than necessarily a kind of a widespread movement. It was very much a hardcore thing.
Well, I'm shortly going to go off to binge watch ten seasons of Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, but wow, excellent. In one day.
not really. But anyway, you can contact us if you wish. Best way is on Twitter. SuperJules84 is Juliet, Sir Terence is me. Jules, you're on the radio this week.
I am, yes. And not live, but with repeats of my Christmas shows that I did last week. So on Wednesday, the Indie Wonderland Big Fat Indie Christmas will be repeated. And some people might be interested in that, because we had some problems with the website this week. So hopefully it's now operational again. So if you missed that, I haven't put it up on Mixcloud yet, so it might be worth waiting for the repeat on Wednesday, 8 till 10 on barricaderadio.com. And then the Saturday Social Christmas Special is repeated on Boxing Day from 6 till 7. And these are all just Christmas songs. So 6 till 7, barricaderadio.com, Saturday the 26th, Boxing Day. If you still want to hang on to the last vestiges of Christmas, then that's the thing for you to do, I think.
We're sort of we're not doing this next week, but I'm going to in the week I'm going to put together a kind of seasonal special. Ooh, not a Christmas
nice.
Special, but a kind of wintry sound. Yeah, Winterval soundscape. You know, wintry tunes, poetry, various
lovely.
Sounds.
I'm looking forward to that.
I did one for autumn, and people seem
really
quite
nice,
like it.
Actually,
so yeah,
and also, of course, it means that I get a little bit more time to feed my fat little face, and that is very good news. I'm determined to fill this onesie with flab. That's my Christmas week goal.
We'll be back to normal on the New Year weekend.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thanks to Rona on her island, of course, as ever, and indeed for the whole year.
Yes, indeed. I for one, welcome our new Rona overlords, to quote The Simpsons. Mm. Yes.
What are we playing out with, Jules?
We're playing out with, I heard the original of this earlier this week. I am, in order to keep myself going through quite a busy and stressful week, I had a lovely 3-CD compilation, I can recommend this, called Our Generation, which is a lot of mod things, but it's a lot wider than most mod compilations usually are. It's got lots of good Northern Soul on it, but it's got lots of sort of the reggae and ska type stuff as well. And I found myself sort of swooning over Our Day Will Come by Ruby and the Romantics, which I'm not really a love song sort of person, but I thought it was absolutely beautiful, very sort of gentle and lovely lyrics. And I found myself thinking, you know, when you think at the back of your mind, oh, so-and-so would be really good at this. I thought, wow, this is the sort of song that Amy Winehouse would be born to sing. And then lo and behold, I Googled it, and I must have remembered that at the back of my mind, because she did do a version. And Terence and I were talking off air about sort of what a great singer Amy Winehouse was, and particularly what a great interpreter she was of other people's material, because she seemed to have that 1950s sound already. And I think that she manages to sound smooth without sounding bland. And I think this is an absolutely lovely version. The original by Ruby and the Romantics is great, but I think this is as good. This is Amy Winehouse. It was from the Hidden Treasures album they put together after she died. And whilst I'm not usually a big fan of digging up old people's kind of older material that, you know, maybe shouldn't have been released and they're trying to cash in, I'm really glad they found this, because I think this is lovely. This is Our Day Will Come.
Timber. You have been listening to a DAC Media production.
I don't like the ball boys provocating the players, because in the end of the day happens what happened last year at Swansea, when a player loses a little bit his temper, and after that the player is guilty of something that is not guilty. So I think it's not right to educate kids to do that.
What did you say to the ball boy when you went over?
I told him for not to do that, because he has a risk of one of my players to punch him or to lose his temper, so don't do that, because you are risking. But somebody told him to do that.